Iran unveils its latest achievements in nuclear technology, including radiopharmaceuticals, plasma, laser, and power generation programs. A Palestinian is killed and over a dozen injured in an armed confrontation with Israeli forces who raided the Jenin refugee camp. Also coming up, Pakistan's parliament is gearing up for a no-confidence vote, and a motion expected to decide the fate of Prime Minister Imran Khan. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran has, in a ceremony, unveiled several pieces of domestically developed nuclear equipment, as well as radiopharmaceuticals. The event marked National Nuclear Technology Day, which is celebrated on April 9th every year. Yusuf Jalali has more.
Iran's nuclear energy program has redefined the country's domestic and foreign policies since the country indigenized the industry. Every year on April 9th, Iran showcases the latest nuclear achievements to mark National Nuclear Technology Day. With President Ebrahim Raisi in attendance, the ceremony this year saw the unveiling of 9 new products out of a total of 77 pieces of nuclear-related equipment produced recently. The president boasted that Iran's nuclear advances were made while the country was under Western pressure.
They didn't want us to have our own domestic nuclear industry. They tried their best to stop us. They assassinated our nuclear scientists, they imposed sanctions, and even targeted our nuclear facilities with explosions. But here we are treading on our path toward greater success in the nuclear industry.
Today, we have extended our nuclear know-how to an extent that we can use it in a range of industries such as agriculture and health, such as radio medicine. We will generate 10,000 megawatts of nuclear-powered electricity and are planning to build an entirely domestic 360-megawatt nuclear power plant.
The event comes as Iran and the world powers are wrapping up talks over the revival of the 2015 deal, which promised Tehran sanctions relief in return for curbs on its nuclear program. The accord has faced trouble since the U.S. unilaterally left it in 2018 and reinstated anti-Iran sanctions. That prompted Iran and other signatories to the accord to launch the Vienna talks to fix the ailing deal.
You know, we have already finished the discussions and negotiation there. As you have heard from our foreign minister, it is time for decision. They have to make difficult decision. That depends, of course, to them to decide if really they want to come back to the deal. This is the Americans that they have to decide. Of course, we are working in an organization dealing with technical issues, not with political issues. But we are looking forward to see that if there is a deal there, then we will implement the deal based on our obligations.
Iran designated April 9th as the Nuclear Technology Day back in 2006, when the country enriched uranium on an industrial scale for the first time. Since then, the country has seen a steady progress in the sector, from building nuclear power plants to centrifuges and radiopharmaceuticals. So Nuclear Technology Day is seen as an occasion for the country to reaffirm its right to a peaceful nuclear energy program.
Sanctions have been haunting Iran's nuclear program since the country indigenized the key sector. Tehran calls the sanctions illegal and unfair, for it has insisted before the conclusion of the 2015 deal, up until now when the Vienna talks are underway, that weapons of mass destruction have no place on the Islamic Republic's agenda, and that its nuclear program is totally civilian. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinians have held a funeral for a Palestinian shot dead by Israeli forces in the Jenin refugee camp, north of the occupied West Bank. At least 5 Palestinians were also injured in the shootout. Israeli troops raided the camp and besieged the home of a young Palestinian man who was allegedly behind a shooting in Tel Aviv on Thursday night. A number of Israeli forces were injured in the ensuing firefight and were airlifted to medical centers. During the Tel Aviv shooting, at least 3 Israelis were killed and 8 more wounded. Israeli regime forces later killed the Palestinian shooter.
Everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. The situation has been tense in Israel during the past days amid consecutive Palestinian operations that has left more than a dozen Israelis dead. The Palestinian operation took place in central Tel Aviv, leaving 3 Israelis dead and some 10 others injured. The Palestinian suspect was later killed in a confrontation with Israeli troops. Palestinian resistance groups have hailed the operation as a legitimate response to continued Israeli crimes. They also say that the operation proved Israel's fragility, as well as the ability of the Palestinian resistance to take the battle to the depths of the enemy's entity. Our first tweet of the day comes from A.Ibrahim Imsabeh. Any Palestinian reaction comes as a normal response to the Israeli ongoing crimes and violations perpetrated against Palestinians along all occupied Palestinian territories. Abbas Hamida tweeted, criminal Zionists keep playing the victim card really hard on Twitter in response to Palestinian resistance. Imagine that this is only the tip of the iceberg. How long do they think they can occupy, terrorize, and continue to play victims? They're too busy getting assurances. Samer has our next tweet. The attack on Palestinian children in their capital during the month of Ramadan and the abuse they were subjected to is inevitably matched by a response in the heart of your capital that you claim. Hashtag apartheid Israel. AKM Shaladan says it's a normal reaction from a Palestinian commando against the crimes Israeli occupation forces have done to the Palestinians every day in the West Bank. For every action, there is a reaction, as is known to everyone, and this was only our response. Hashtag Free Palestine. Israeli atrocities against Palestinians have been going on even after the beginning of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, and our next batch of comments showcases the aggressive behavior of Israeli troops towards the Palestinians in the occupied territories, with the first video being posted by Ghada Owais. She says, Israeli occupation, Israeli apartheid, collective punishment against Palestinians, demolitions, administrative detention, restricting Al-Aqsa access, cruel system of domination, and the crimes against humanity committed by Israeli authorities won't bring peace. Clearly, Israel is not looking for peace. All they want is more and more Palestinian land. Rami Abdel Jabbar said, Israeli occupation forces prevented hundreds of Palestinians from the occupied West Bank from crossing into occupied Al-Quds through Qalandiyya checkpoint to perform Friday prayer at Al-Aqsa Mosque. Many have criticized the Western double standards in dealing with the situation in Ukraine and Palestine. People say that the Western support for Ukraine against the Russian offensive and their condemnation of the Palestinian resistance against Israeli occupation is the true meaning of double standards. Our next batch of comments starts with a tweet by Ibrahim. Lie, then lie, and manipulate the truth so that people believe you. This is how U.S. imperialism and the colonial West deal with Palestine resistance and the war in Ukraine in their false propaganda of demonizing Russia and the Palestinian resistance. The American media is not free. I mean, what else is new? That's the job of the mainstream media, to make people believe you. That'll do it for another Hashtag Trending. Let's head back to the studio for the rest of the world news.
Ukraine is calling for harsher sanctions against Russia after a missile attack hit a train station in the eastern city of Kramatorsk. That attack left 52 people dead. President Volodymyr Zelensky says the strike was a deliberate attack on civilians and a war crime. He says Kyiv expects a firm global response and called for an energy embargo on Russia. Zelensky also called for all Russian banks to be cut off from the global system and demanded more weapons. He says any delay in providing arms for Ukraine would mean politicians want to help Moscow more than Kyiv. The Kremlin, at the same time, has urged the West to stop supplying weapons to Kyiv and blamed the Ukrainian military for the Kramatorsk attack.
Today, on April 8th, the Ukrainian military struck the railway station of Kramatorsk with a Tochka-U missile. Tochka-U missiles, which remains were found near the railway station, are used only by the Ukrainian military.
Russia's defense ministry also says the missiles were launched from a Donbas territory controlled by Ukrainian forces. The conflict is now in its 45th day. According to the UN's Human Rights Office, over 1,600 civilians have been killed in Ukraine. More than 2,200 others have been injured, while another 11,000 have left their homes. Footage has been released, apparently showing Ukrainian soldiers executing a Russian prisoner of war outside of a village west of the capital, Kyiv. In the video, at least 3 men can be seen lying dead next to a 4th man who is breathing heavily with a jacket covering his head. Then a voice is heard saying that he is still breathing. Afterwards, a soldier shoots the man twice in the head. The man continues to move. The soldier shoots again, and he stops. The living soldiers in the video are wearing the Ukrainian colors of blue and yellow on their arms. The men on the floor wear white armbands, which are used by Russian troops. The video was first shared on Telegram, and some Western media outlets have verified it. The Ukrainian government has pledged an investigation. China has warned of, quote, serious consequences of Russia's suspension from the UN Human Rights Council. It says the move will simply fan the flames of war in Ukraine.
The drafting process of the relevant resolution was not open or transparent, nor did it follow the practice of going through consultations of all member states and heeding views extensively. This way of doing things will only aggravate the division among member states, intensify contradictions among the parties concerned, and add fuel to the fire, which is not conducive to de-escalating the conflict, still less pushing for peace negotiations. To handle the issue of membership of the Human Rights Council this way will set a new dangerous precedent, further intensifying confrontation and induce a still bigger impact on the UN governance system with serious consequences.
Zhao Lijian also stated that China is against politicizing human rights to pressure other countries. The Chinese official cautioned against what he called a selective approach toward the issue of human rights. This after the UN General Assembly voted to suspend Russia from the Human Rights Council. China was among the 24 countries against the U.S.-initiated motion. Meantime, Moscow has labeled the vote illegal and politically driven. Russia stands accused of human rights violations and abuses in Ukraine, but the Kremlin denies the accusation. Just a day ahead of France's presidential polls, the race for the top job is reaching its climax. The two main rivals, incumbent Emmanuel Macron and far-right leader Marine Le Pen, are making last-minute appeals to win more votes. Still, there are indications that a large segment of the French public might be reluctant to cast their ballots because they're unhappy with the presidential campaign and the status quo in general. Our correspondent in Paris, Romain Mazaré, tells us more.
Well, it's been a very surprising election in that nobody has seemed to care about it, not in the rest of the world or in France. That's really very different from 2017, when neither of the two mainstream parties made it to the second round for the first time since Charles de Gaulle. What Ukraine really did is provide Macron with a way to avoid campaigning. So he didn't have his first campaign until about a week ago. So he has been criticized as hiding behind the campaign. Hiding behind Ukraine to avoid campaigning. What the French people care about is it's always been the same. It's been purchasing power. Inflation has just soared in recent months. It's at gut-wrenching levels now for the average household. The far right is really gaining ground for many reasons. It's been a process. You have Nicolas Sarkozy, who introduced Islamophobia. You have François Hollande, who made it mainstream, who made it acceptable. And now you have Macron's term, which has institutionalized Islamophobia. So what we see here is not the far right gaining ground in sort of one section of the population, but that all of France has become more far right on this cultural issue of immigration, Islam, Muslims.
Italy's nurses and healthcare workers have staged a national strike affecting hospitals across the country. Unionists are calling on the government to review the collective contract, adjusting salaries to meet changes in skyrocketing costs of living.
On Friday, tens of thousands of nurses and non-medical health professionals walked off their job and staged a nationwide strike demanding improved pay and better nurse-to-patient ratios. The industrial action had been called by a number of healthcare unions in response to the government's inaction that had followed another strike called in January. Italy's nurses have been celebrated as heroes for treating desperately ill coronavirus patients, often with little equipment and knowledge of the illness. However, today they feel forgotten.
In the midst of the pandemic, the Prime Minister himself said we won't forget about the nurses. The truth is that they have forgotten about us. We were expecting a pay raise considering the challenges and the suffering we had to go through during the pandemic. Negotiations are underway for the contractual renewal of the health sector. Let's see how it unfolds.
About 450,000 nurses are currently employed in Italy, a country with a population of about 60 million people. According to a recent OECD report, the average gross annual salary for nurses is among the lowest in Europe, while the ratio between nurses and the population is 6 per 1,000 inhabitants, against 18 in Switzerland and Norway, 13 in Germany and 11 in France.
The pandemic has further shown that a shortage of nurses is greatly affecting Italy's healthcare system. Nurses are exhausted today. They had to go through insurmountable challenges during the COVID crisis, including the lack of appropriate gear, knowledge, and the high number of patients. Also, some mismanagement on the part of the hospital administrations made things harder. In some regions where hospitals are run mostly by private companies, the healthcare system has collapsed catastrophically because of the COVID.
Privatized and commercialized, Italy's healthcare system has been thrown upside down over the past 20 years. A system in which private and public clinics compete for taxpayers' money came into play in 1997 when Rome opted to decentralize the Italian healthcare system and give more autonomy to regional governments. Lombardy is one of the Italian regions where the healthcare private sector is largely supported by public funding. It was also one of the worst hit regions in Europe by COVID-19 and the epicenter at the beginning of the European outbreak. Experts believe that Lombardy's fragmented healthcare system snarled the lines of command across the region, throwing hospitals into chaos. That caused the deaths of thousands of people during the first wave of COVID in Italy. Max Civili, Rome.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Many Yemenis feel that the war on their country has been forgotten, despite its significantly higher death toll and the fact that it is marked by much more blatant violations of human rights. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ahmed Abdul Karim, journalist. This article is published under the heading, On its 7th anniversary, Yemen seeks to end a war the world has forgotten. This is the second part of the article. Min Press spoke to Yemenis who lost loved ones and were forced to flee their homes, now living in makeshift refugee camps in Sana'a, due to the Saudi-led, U.S.-backed coalition against Yemen. They see the burning fields of neighboring Saudi Arabia as their last hope to deter the oil-rich kingdom from igniting its own fires on their war-torn homeland. There may be some merit to their assertion. In the wake of recent attacks, a two-month truce has been announced by the United Nations. The UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grönberg, announced the truce as a move aimed at providing an environment conducive to a peaceful settlement of the conflict. The deal stipulates a halting of offensive military operations, including cross-border attacks, and allowing fuel ships to enter Yemen's Hodeidah port, as well as the resumption of commercial flights in and out of the Sana'a International Airport to predetermined destinations in the region. The truce, which went into effect and was ostensibly welcomed by both Saudi Arabia and Yemen, has raised the hope of many around the world that an end to this war is possible, but few Yemenis are sold. "We don't buy it," Ibrahim Abdul Karim told Min Press, adding, "In 2015, an American bomb was dropped on my home in Sana'a by a Saudi warplane, killing my brother's daughter." A photo of Ibrahim hugging the body of his deceased daughter went viral and became a symbol of the brutal war. Ibrahim still suffers, and his disabled wife is unable to travel abroad for treatment because of the Saudi blockade. Ibrahim's fears are not unfounded. At least three people were killed when Saudi border forces launched a barrage of rockets and artillery rounds at a residential area in the Shadar region in northwestern province of Sa'ade just hours after Saudi Arabia agreed to the recent truce. Moreover, Saudi forces have breached the truce in Hodeidah 81 times in the 24 hours preceding the writing of the article. According to Ansarullah's liaison and coordination officer's operation room, other recent violations of the truce include multiple Saudi spy flights, 25 episodes of artillery shelling, and 66 shooting incidents. Efforts to lift the siege at any cost have been gaining widespread political and social support in Yemen. This was the sentiment expressed at a recent demonstration and many rallies commemorating the 7th anniversary of the war on March 26th, now marked as the National Day of Steadfastness. In Sana'a, where the largest demonstrations took place, Ali Guesh donned traditional Yemeni attire and carried a striped red, white, black national flag as he shouted chants of support for Ansarullah's forces. Despite being in his 80s, Guesh has not missed a National Day of Steadfastness protest since he lost two of his sons in a Saudi attack. A resident of Rawda, Guesh joined the huge gathering in Bab al-Yemen district, along with hundreds of thousands of residents from the suburbs of Sana'a and its neighboring provinces. In Hodeidah, thousands took to the streets to denounce the war and blockade. There were similar mass demonstrations in 30 provinces and cities, including Sa'de, Hajje, Al-Jawf, Al-Bayda, Ta'ez, Amran, Eb, Dhamar, Al-Mawhid, Raimeh, Al-Dhale and Ma'reb. Protesters carried Yemeni flags, Kalashnikov rifles, posters of Ansarullah leaders and banners lauding recent attacks against Saudi Arabia. The protests organized by Ansarullah were not only to commemorate the day the war on Yemen first began in 2015, but also to pledge full liberation from the blockade. Mohammed bin Salman must end the blockade, not bring in a deceptive truce, if he wishes to escape from his difficult situation, Guaish told Mint Press. Many Yemenis feel that the war on their country has been forgotten despite its significantly higher death toll and the fact that it is marked by much more blatant violations of human rights. In fact, violence, starvation and disease that have been meted out to Yemen unhindered for the past 7 years are being made acutely worse, which has caused the price of food and fuel in Yemen to skyrocket. About 80% of Yemen's 30 million people need humanitarian assistance. Moreover, 360,000 children under the age of 5 are severely malnourished. By the end of 2022, the number of people experiencing catastrophic hunger is expected to rise fivefold, from 31,000 to 161,000, bringing the total number of people in need to 7.3 million. Since 2015, when the Saudi-led coalition began its bombing campaign in Yemen, thousands of homes have burned to the ground, often with whole families inside, and schools, factories, hospitals, mosques, and markets are rendered piles of soot and ash following massive infernos sparked by near-constant Saudi airstrikes, backed by the United States and many world countries.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of the commander of the faithful Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi al-salam. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, in one of his letters to one of his commanders, Malik al-Ashtar, he talks about human rights, and he wants Malik, obviously, to apply human rights to its last drop, if we can say that. Amongst the beautiful things that Amir al-Mu'mineen mentions to Malik that he wants him to apply in terms of human rights, he talks about open conferences with those who are poor and those who are in need, which means those who are oppressed and those who are in need, they have the right to be heard, which we see in a lot of systems and governments currently, such voices are never heard because no one cares and no one gives them the opportunity. Where we see Amir al-Mu'minin saying that should not happen. He says to him, meet the oppressed and the lowly, those who are obviously low in terms of status and in terms of wealth, periodically. So it's not a one-time thing. You need to see them either on a weekly basis, monthly basis. So there has to be constantly seen and spoken to so they can be heard, their concerns are heard, and their demands are met. In an open conference, obviously it has to be done publicly, where everyone can see that you are actually trying to provide for people. You are trying to meet the human rights aspect when it comes to them. You're not just doing it even because sometimes a ruler or a person in power, a person in authority, he might listen to those who are poor and he might come to their help. But because people don't know about it, they might accuse him for being an oppressor. So the Imam says, make sure it's done publicly. And he says to him, have a heart-to-heart talk with them. Because sometimes just listening is not going to do the trick. A person needs to have that soft, gentle love towards those whom he's talking to. Because sometimes we have all these people coming from government side to represent the government. They come with their cars and their bodyguards, and they could hardly talk to you, and they have this arrogance of pride, and you can't even say two words, and then they pretend that they have listened to your concerns, and then they leave. Amir al-Mu'minin says, no, that's not going to work. First, see them on a regular basis. Talk to them heart to heart. And specifically, he says, make sure none of your armed guards or civil officers or police department members or intelligent members of the intelligence department are by your side. Because people sometimes, when they see that a person is in a parade of police and bodyguards and no one can even approach that person, that makes them fear, especially if they want to use, the intelligence department. People will fear for their life. So even if they have needs, they will keep quiet. They will not say nothing. So Amir al-Mu'minin says, make sure you come by yourself. You leave all these hooligans outside and talk to people one-to-one to ensure that their rights are met. Let us take a short break, and then we'll continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Amir al-Mu'minin, he thinks, and no, Amir al-Mu'minin, he tries to teach us and tell us the rights of people. One of their rights is for them to be heard. And being heard, according to Amir al-Mu'minin, has adequates. It's not just listening. It has to be done in a simple and different manner than what we are used to currently. First, he says, make sure it's periodic. It's done constantly, heart to heart, gentle and soft talk, no police force and no guards whatsoever. And then he says, bear with composure any strong language which they may use. Dealing with people who are in need, I don't feel their pain. They know their own pain. So whatever pain I'm going through, no one can understand that. Only me. So sometimes when I speak with a person, when I have a problem and I want to express my problem, sometimes I use a strong language to express my concerns or my pain or my suffering. Now, the other person who's on the other side of the fence, he should be considerate of my language. He should not take it that I am trying to become abusive or I'm trying to become rude or annoying or what have you. Actually, on the contrary, he should say, you know what, that person obviously has a problem and he's talking from pain, so I give him the benefit of the doubt. So Amir al-Mu'minin saying to Malik, that is a right of the people for them to use and express themselves in a very strong language. And you have to bear with composure. You need to hold your anger. You need to be very calm, very relaxed. Even if they swear at you, even if they curse you, even if they do whatever they want to do in terms of language, you have to bear that in mind. And do not get annoyed if they cannot state their cause lucidly, because sometimes we have that problem also. The people have a problem. They just don't know how to express it. I don't even know how to put it in words clearly, which makes a person who's listening annoyed. It's like, get to the point. I can't understand what you guys want from me. So Amir al-Mu'minin is saying to him, don't get annoyed. You know, be open-minded. Be calm. This is also a right of people, right? To be heard and to be given enough time for them to express themselves. And he says to him, even so, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will open for you his doors of blessings and reward, considering the fact that you give them that right. Whatever you can give them, give it without asking for anything in reward, and make it clear to them with the utmost love and respect to those people. It is their right. You're not doing them a favor. You are there to serve them. They have concerns, they have pain, they have suffering, okay? So, and people are different. You might be educated, you might be well educated, you might be fluent in Arabic or, you know, talking and communication. People are not the same. So first, make sure you're composed. If they use any language, strong language, okay, that's not a problem. Do not lose your composure, and also give them time to express themselves and be generous. If you do this, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, on the other hand, not only he will give you the blessings of helping you out, but he will also give you the reward in this world and in the next. And this is exactly how precise Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam when it comes to the matter of human rights. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. In the United States, Ali Alexander, who was a key figure in the Stop the Steal movement, said he had received a grand jury subpoena and would assist the expanding Justice Department investigation. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Alan Feuer. The piece is titled Pro-Trump Rally Planner is Cooperating in Justice Department's January 6 Inquiry. Ali Alexander, a prominent organizer of pro-Trump events after the 2020 presidential election, has agreed to cooperate with the Justice Department's investigation of the attack on the Capitol last year. The first high-profile political figure known to have offered assistance to the government's newly expanded criminal inquiry. Speaking through a lawyer, Mr. Alexander said on Friday that he had recently received a subpoena from a federal grand jury that is seeking information on several broad categories of people connected to pro-Trump rallies that took place in Washington after the election. In a statement from the lawyer, Mr. Alexander said he was taking a cooperative posture with the Justice Department's investigation, but did not know what useful information he could give. He also disavowed anyone who took part in or planned violence on 6th of January 2021. While it remains unclear what Mr. Alexander might tell the grand jury, he was intimately involved in the sprawling effort to mount political protests challenging the results of the 2020 presidential election and had contacts with other organizers, extremist groups, members of Congress and, according to the House committee investigating the 6th of January riot, White House officials during the period after Election Day. The grand jury, empaneled by federal prosecutors, is looking into a wide range of issues surrounding former President Donald J. Trump's efforts to overturn the results of the election, after months in which the Justice Department focused on rioters directly involved in the storming of the Capitol. In early December, Mr. Alexander voluntarily sat for a deposition with the House committee and gave it a trove of documents that help shed light on the activities that preceded the Capitol attack. Grand jury subpoena Mr. Alexander received suggests that prosecutors have greatly widened the scope of their inquiry to include not only people who were at the Capitol, but also those who organized and spoke at pro-Trump events in November and December of 2020, and on 6th of January 2021. In an indication that the inquiry could reach into the Trump administration and its allies in Congress, the subpoena also seeks information about members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who were involved in the events or who may have helped to obstruct the certification of the 2020 election. Mr. Alexander took part in two so-called Stop the Steal rallies in Washington that preceded the former president's event at the Ellipse near the White House on 6th of January 2021. One on 14th of November 2020 and the other a few weeks later on 12th of December 2020, as well as events in the key swing state of Georgia in December. In the run-up to those gatherings, Ali Alexander came into contact with a host of rally organizers and with right-wing groups like the Oath Keepers Militia and the First Amendment Praetorian that provided both public and personal security at the events. In the statement from his lawyer, he said he did not coordinate any movements with far-right extremist groups at his events. Ali Alexander also had a permit for an event on the east side of the Capitol on 6th of January 2021, that never took place because of the violence that erupted on that day. In the days and weeks before the rally, he was in touch with people in the White House and members of Congress according to the House Committee's letter seeking his deposition. Mr. Alexander has said that he, along with Representatives Mo Brooks of Alabama, Paul Gosar of Arizona, and Andy Biggs of Arizona, all Republicans, helped set the events of 6th of January 2021 in motion. We four schemed up of putting maximum pressure on Congress while they were voting, Mr. Alexander said in a since-deleted video posted online, so that who we couldn't lobby, we could change the hearts and the minds of Republicans who were in that body, hearing our loud roar from outside. Ali Alexander declined to answer any questions about his ties to the White House or members of Congress. He also declined to discuss whether he came up with the idea of marching to the Capitol himself, or the notion emerged from conversations with others. While Mr. Alexander is the first pro-Trump political organizer to acknowledge his cooperation with the government, several far-right militants, including members of the Oath Keepers militia, have also reached cooperation deals with prosecutors. Those Oath Keepers working with the government could help prosecutors with the sprawling seditious conspiracy case that was filed in January against the Oath Keepers founder, Stuart Rhodes, and 10 other members of the militia group. At a court hearing in Washington on Friday, a leader of a North Carolina chapter of the Proud Boys also announced that under a plea deal with the government, he would cooperate with the Justice Department's investigation of 6th of January riot. The Proud Boys leader, Charles Donahoe, was charged in a conspiracy case with 5 other Proud Boys, including the organization's former chairman, Enrique Tarrio. In court papers released after the hearing, Mr. Donahoe admitted that several leaders and members of the Proud Boys had discussed using force and violence to disrupt the certification of the 2020 presidential election results, to show Congress that we the people were in charge. The papers also say that the Proud Boys were discussing storming the Capitol before going to Washington in January, and that Charles Donahoe believed the attack on the building would achieve the group's goal of stopping the government from carrying out the transfer of presidential power. One subject that Ali Alexander might help prosecutors better understand is the bitter rivalries that often divided the small group of planners that put together pro-Trump events in Washington after the election. When he testified to the committee, Ali Alexander told congressional investigators that he faltered poor planning by organizers like Amy Kramer and her daughter Kylie Kramer, who ran a group called Women for America First, that helped set up Donald Trump's event at the Ellipse. He said, for example, that leaders of the Ellipse event removed instructions from their program, telling attendees exactly where to go and what to do after the gathering concluded. Mr. Alexander might also be able to shed light on some of the activities on 6th of January 2021 of a man he considers to be something of a mentor, Roger Stone, a longtime advisor to Donald Trump. Mr. Alexander said, through his lawyer, that in the run-up to 6th of January, he spoke with Roger Stone about logistics and the warring factions of organizers, and provided the House Committee with all of his communications with Mr. Stone on the day of the Capitol attack. On that day, Mr. Alexander attended Donald Trump's speech at the Ellipse, then marched with the crowd towards the Capitol, along with the conspiracy theorist Alex Jones of InfoWars. He arrived, as he put it, in his prepared remarks to the House Committee, in the early stages of the law-breaking. But on Friday, he insisted through his lawyer that he had not observed any crimes being committed during the planning of the rally on 6th of January. "I did nothing wrong, and I'm not in possession of evidence that anyone else had plans to commit unlawful acts," his statement said. After the building had been breached, Ali Alexander posted a video of himself on social media watching the crowd march on the Capitol from a terrace a few blocks away. "I don't disavow this," he said in the video, which was preserved by the organisation Right Wing Watch. "I do not denounce this." In his statement on Friday, Ali Alexander said the video did not include remarks he had made that day, specifying that he was speaking only of the protesters approaching the Capitol grounds, and he reiterated that he did not support violence. "I want to be clear now," he said in his statement. "I disavow and denounce anyone who in any way planned to occupy buildings or engage in violence on 6th of January 2021. You
have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a heralder of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr.
Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very noble and beautiful hadith, which has been narrated from Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. And this hadith is about leniency and the benefits of leniency. In Arabic, we call it arifq, leniency, being lenient with people, tolerating them. You know, if they're, you know, being harsh to you, you'd be lenient with them. This is one of the virtues in Islam. And in this tradition, Imam Zainul Abidin has spoken about it. As you know, we're in the month of Ramadan right now, and the month of Ramadan is a kind of a very difficult time for people. And, you know, a lot of times it's an unusual situation, right? So we're going to sleep, you know, late, right? Because we're eating iftar late. Then we have to wake up early in the morning for suhoor. A lot of times the women have to wake up more earlier than the other ones to cook the suhoor for the family, right? So this attribute of being lenient with one another is very pertinent and important for us in this holy month of Ramadan. So let's be lenient with one another. Let's tolerate one another. Let's try to get through this month of Ramadan. Inshallah, let's not like ruin our acts of worship, you know, by being upset with one another and fighting with one another in this holy month. Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam says, the last piece of advice that Al-Khizr, the Prophet Khizr, gave to the Prophet Moses was the following. If any of you are acquainted with the Holy Quran, you know that in the Surah Kahf, which is one of the surahs and chapters of the Holy Quran, there's a story about the Prophet Moses alayhi salam. You know, God Almighty guided him to one of his servants, the Prophet Al-Khizr, who is a famous prophet, who is still alive today, in fact, which is interesting enough. And the Prophet Khizr and the Prophet Moses, they went on a small adventure. Certain things happened to them. Very interesting story. If any of you get the chance, you can read this story in the Holy Quran. It's very instructive and educational, and we can learn a lot from it. The last piece of advice that the Prophet Khizr gave to the Prophet Moses was this. When a person is lenient with someone in this world, Allah will be lenient with him on the day of resurrection. A very beautiful hadith. If we are lenient with one another, if we're tolerant with one another, Allah will be tolerant with us. In the hereafter, he will restrain himself from getting angry with us. He will restrain himself from punishing us, right, for our evil deeds, right? There's a famous tradition, kama tudino tudan, as you act, so you will be dealt with. As you deal with other people, Allah will deal with you in the hereafter, right? So if we're lenient with people, we're nice to them, we're kind to them, we tolerate them, Allah will do the same for us in the hereafter and will overlook our faults. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at leniency and its benefits in the words of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.